My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ralph.
And I am interested to see what we're going to get this evening. This idea of this journey through the 12 steps, and we will make it through this weekend. I'm going to twist Charlie's arm, and we'll make it through. And because I think we've divided into, I think, 9 sessions, Terry. So we should probably make it through. We're not going to try to squeeze the juice out of all the steps. And this weekend, it's not going to be a primer on the steps. It's not going to be, as Tarek said, we're not going to mechanically do a 4-step and show anybody else how to do a new one. What we are going to do this weekend is I'm going to share my experience with this process and how it's transformed me. And I'm going to share, you know, my sobriety date is October the 11th of 1986. So, and Charlie will give you his, but suffice it to say, Charlie kept the light on for me. So we, and I'm going to share experience with this process. I was listening to the guy who's considered probably by most maybe the preeminent historian of Alcoholics Anonymous, Ernie Kurtz. And Kurtz wrote a book, Not God, and if you haven't read it, the first half, very interesting. The second half, anyway, it's a doctoral thesis, and the second half reads more like a doctoral thesis. The first half reads like a history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Kurtz has a thing in there, and this is going to be interesting for this weekend. He said his idea is that this quest for knowledge and information is actually, you know, a form of control. A form of control, you know, and if I suffer from an illness that, you know, that only a spiritual experience can conquer, I just leaped ahead into the second step, you know. But if I suffer from that, this idea of constantly searching for more information, my sponsor has a phrase, and he says, Ralph, you got to know when to get off the donkey. And Charlie is really familiar with my sponsor. And I know that phrase doesn't mean a lot. I want you to put it on the board. Mentally put it on the board. We're going to revisit that. I'm going to go back to that. Know when to get off the donkey. You know, but let's talk about, in this session, we'll talk about the first step. You know, and not only am I an alcoholic, I am... I'm a smoker. You know, not just a cocaine addict, I'm a smoker. And so in October 1986, I was at the end of my rope. I was in the last days. Bill talks about how dark it is before the dawn. On October the 10th, 1986, I didn't know October the 11th, 1986 was going to be my day. Most of us don't set an appointment. You know, and that's not how this deal works. And I had a long history, you know, just really brief. And that's the way the first step has to be. The first step is a conclusion I draw based on my experience. You know, and I had a lot of experience. I didn't start out, and my experience is not one that I started really early and getting loaded. You know, I started very late. My father was an alcoholic, and my vow was, I'm not going to be like my old man. You know, and it wasn't that he was abusive or he was a violent man. He was more absent than he was present, and he wasn't the guy I was proud of. He wasn't a Huxtable dad. He wasn't, you know, the football dad. My dad was just a janitor, and he seemed weak to me, and I was always embarrassed by him. Because I've always been the kind of guy that's been really self-absorbed, real early, elementary school. I can remember walking down the hall in elementary school, and I'm walking, right? And then all of a sudden, because I'm a square guy, right? I'm a studious guy. I'm a nerd, and I'm square. You know, I grew up in Watts, but, you know, not everybody in Watts was a tough guy. You know, me and my brothers, we were schoolboys. And I'm walking down the hall, you know, and I kind of probably had a nerdy walk. But then I remember, you know, putting the little pimp in my straw, because I was thinking, you know, they might be looking at me on candid camera. You know, real thought. That was a real thought. I'm that guy. I've always been that guy. I'm walking down the hall. I'm about 8 or 9 years old. Candid camera. Okay, there's some youngsters in here. They're like, what's Candy Camera? Think the real life videos or something they do. But Candy Camera was a show where they follow people anyway. But I thought they might be watching me on Candy Camera. I'm that dude. I'm the guy that when I'm walking up the street, and these are thoughts that used to be with me even as a kid. I walk by you, and I'm walking this way, you walking that way. And I remember thinking, when you disappear from my view, you no longer exist. If you're not in my orbit, immediately in my orbit, you don't exist. So I've been a self-absorbed guy for a long time. But that doesn't make me alcoholic. That just makes me a self-absorbed guy, right? It's self-absorbed guys that ain't never touched it. You know, but I'm going along and I'm going along and I'm going along square, you know, but I'm sharp and I'm a smart guy and I'm a studious guy. I'm a schoolboy. So I'm 16 years old before I touch anything. I touch anything. Now, what alcohol did for me, which is the first thing I touched, what alcohol did for me, it didn't make me taller. It didn't make me stronger. It didn't make me more handsome, you know, because I was never the cat in school. You know, I got, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I got in vogue for girls as I was an adult. Now y'all are looking for guys who have a job and a paycheck. But in junior high school, you want the pretty boy, you want the player, and I was never that guy. I used to be so mad at the player, you know, and the cool guy, you know. But so I'm 16, you know, I get this girl, but it didn't make me stronger, it didn't make me more handsome, it didn't make me a more player, it didn't do any of what it made me, what alcohol did for me, it made the real me come out. It made the real me come out. Inside of me, I always felt like y'all was missing out. I didn't know how to tell you, but you were missing out. I always had, you know, I got that kind of thing working inside of me all the time. This superior, inferior thing, never across the board. I heard a speaker share one time, if you treat me special, I feel normal. If you treat me normal, I feel rejected. Identify with that. That's me. That's me. You know, so I'm growing up, and so now I discover this thing, alcohol, but I don't start getting loaded immediately. I'm 16. I'm on a fast track for success. You know, I drink every now and then in school. You know, I'm a real political guy in school. It's the 60s. I'm running around doing political stuff. Drugs are a scourge to my community. You know, I was a drug counselor, a peer counselor. I never shared that in my story. You know, but I was all that, you know, as a kid growing up. And so in 71, I get into UCLA, and I start rolling with big dogs. And that's who I am. I'm a fraudulent guy. I'm a perpetrator. You know, I'm a what I think you think about me guy. And so I'm offering no back. You know, so the cats I'm running with, first time, you know, so in when I started off in school, my first goal was to be the first black president of the United States. My first goal was to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers. Baseball was my game. But when I got to high school, I never overcame fear of the ball. You can't play ball if you can't get, you know, if you're scared of getting hit in the face. Yeah, I never overcame that. So, you know, my next goal, first black president of the United States, minute. And people in my community used to encourage me because I was a high-achieving guy, right? First kid off my block to go to school and the rest of that. Check out the way this disease is subtle, and it'll creep on you, right? Talk about this powerlessness that I didn't see coming, the progressiveness of the disease I suffer from. First goal. Play shortstop, second goal, first black president of the United States. My next goal, because now when I'm off at school and living in the dorms, you know, I don't care what your major was when you living in the dorm, you minored in smoking weed. You know, that's smoking weed and playing Big West. That's what you do. So now I'm smoking this weed, and that's back in the 70s, three-finger nickels, four-finger dimes, no stems, no seeds. You know, that's how I was doing. You buy, you know, that's where I come from. And so I'm smoking this weed. Check this out. First black president of the United States. All of a sudden, by the end of my freshman year, because I'm one of them square guys, it's some old guys in here that probably remember, they used to have, if you didn't know how to roll joints, they had a red roller with yellow, and the yellow zigzag, them thick yellow zigzag, and I would use this red roller to roll because I didn't know how to roll. And my goal became, I want to be able to be like my older brother. I want to roll one paper, one hand. That was my goal. Where did this first black president of the United States? One paper, one hand. Damn! You know, goals started changing, creeping on me. Didn't know where that started coming from. You know, so now I'm drinking, you know, I'm drinking Spinata, Tyrolia, any Green Springs, Boone's Farm, Youngsters. Then I'm drinking this Southern Comfort. That was my drink. Now I'm drinking this Tanqueray. I'm drinking this Gordon. You know, I'm drinking Gin and Roses Lime. That was my drink. That was my go-to. Gin and Roses Lime juice, you know. And so I'm drinking and I'm getting loaded. 73, a cat came up to me and we were sitting around my apartment and he had some blow. And I'm not doing, that's drugs. Not me, no way, never. You know, I'm still drinking my ass, drinking, smoking herb, you know, I'm drinking. And then next time, another guy came up in the dorm. He was a football player. We were gonna watch him on Sundays. Matter of fact, he had a nice career in the NFL. I'm that guy, I'm the image guy. I'm rolling at this major university. I'm rolling with cats who were going to be political leaders in my town, in this state, and in this country. I'm rolling with people we were going to be watching play football on Sundays. Back in those days, you didn't see people pumping gas and rushing cars. You needed at least a C note to play in that game. It was mirrors and album covers. It was etiquette. It was cool. It was what upwardly mobile people. That's me. That's right in. And I started, man, and it took me down the road, you know. And so now I'm doing it, I'm drinking and I'm using. And it was fun and games for a long time till it wasn't. And then things started happening in my life, and there was no way you could tell me. The thing about powerlessness being such an essential part of our deal, and the reason it's so difficult is because it is difficult. This idea of powerlessness is a difficult thing for a guy like me. I come up in a place and a time, you know, if you don't know the answer, you know, if I don't know that, I'll make it up. You know, I don't come from admitting defeat. If you ever play ball, if you run with guys and you, no, that idea of surrender and admitting defeat, and it take a long time. Who gonna quit when it's still a party? And it was still a party for me for a long time. And it was a party for me in my head, even when it wasn't a party for me anymore. You know, and so I'm doing the deal, and then I start losing. I start suffering L's, and I wasn't used to suffering L's. I got fired from a job in 1979 for the first time, and I didn't associate with my drinking and using. I associated it with Thursday paydays. Why would you pay somebody on Thursday and expect to show up on Friday? That don't even make sense. That's a setup. What kind of, you know, don't even expect, you know. I was at my second inventory before I got real with that one. I really thought Thursday payday was the problem. Suffered my first L. Got married in 1980, you know, made a fool out of myself at the wedding. You know, bam, humiliated myself, humiliated my wife. You know, things started showing up publicly in the family. There should have been signs, you know. I still, you know, the thing about this, the step, first step experience is different for everybody. I hear different people share, and some people share that they had their experience showed them they had tried over and over and over, and they proved to themselves they couldn't stop on their own. That's one of the hardest deals for me, because I never tried to stop till I came to you guys. I never tried. Not everything. You know what I tried to do? Stop spending a whole paycheck every 2 weeks. That's what I tried to do. But I never tried quitting entirely on my own. And you couldn't have convinced me that a guy like me, you know, a make it happen guy, you know, a high achieving guy, put his mind to it and yeah, it's gonna get done guy. And it took a long time for alcohol and drugs to have that effect on me that it started happening, you know, but it started happening. I started taking more and more losses, you know, and I still wasn't connecting the dots. I had a guy come to work one day, and he came, he had had another DUI, and he came in. We used to drink, you know, this is an earlier time. I was working in this insurance company with a bunch of people, and on Fridays we would drink tequila, you know, and with the salt and just suck on a lime, you know, and that's how we, tequila lime. And so we drink that tequila, and one guy came back, and he had had another DUI. And when he came back and we were meeting during work, we meeting in these file things that used to, they call them the stacks, and we meet up in there. And dude said, man, I can't do this. You know, I got another DUI, and they told me, you know, I got to, and he was talking, he said, I got to quit. He said, I can't drive to work no more. He told me I got to quit drinking or quit driving. I said, hell, that's easy. Quit driving. What do you mean? You got to quit drinking. I was real with that. What the hell are you talking about? Quit drinking. That's a no-brainer. You know, no-brainer. You know, but I'm taking them, man, and I'm taking them. And things started really getting bleak for me in the mid-80s. I got married in 1980. Had my first child in 1983. And by now, it's daily. But I'm Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the way that I get out. Right, I'm a business guy by day, but I'm a vampire by night. Cool thing about my story, I don't always, you know, we say, you know, it's a couple of places that are instructive about how we share in the big book. And one of them is our stories disclosed. Most of us have heard that in a general way, what we used to be like. And so when you hear us talk, you hear us in a general way. And it's very general, because you can't condense a life in an hour. You really can't condense it. And then when we get to go out and talk a lot, we condense it because we've done it enough and we know how to get it in so we can all get it in. But the reality of it is, even though I hit the low points, you know, when I started going down and the end started coming, here's the cold thing. I was descending into the disease, but I was rising in the workplace. I was working in 1983. I got a dream job. I started working in management in the law department of a major utility company. I had a salary position. I was no longer an hourly employee. Back in 1983, I was making $32,000 a year annually, and that was a lot of money back then for me. And I was like, wow, I got this annual. I'm in management, you know. And I was working, and I had this big office with a big glass window that let me look out on the workforce, about 80 people. It also allowed the workforce to look in on me. And it's a cold thing. You be coming off one of them runs 6 or 8 days, and you do that whiplash thing and look to see if everybody's looking, and everybody's looking. You know, that's a cold thing, you know. And it's interesting when I look back. What I thought was going to be a high point in my work career ended up being the beginning of the high point of the rest of my life. Because that's when it really started crumbling on me. You know, that's when things really started showing up. They called me in the office and they let me go. And bro, a step before they let me go, I ran up in the treatment. You know, my ex-wife, who was, you know, she had put me out. I got put out the house in 1984. And I started staying at my mom's house. You know, and me and my five brothers are all in. We were all drinking and smoking together. And we almost killed my mom. And I started staying at my mom's in 1985. My ex-wife came by one day. Said, Ralph, my insurance will pay for you if you're willing to go in and get some help. And she called me at the right time. I don't know what a right time is. I really don't know what a right time is. I'd had other times. But she called me, and when she came to my mom's house, she didn't ask me for money. And I was getting ready to try to dodge her. She said, I can take you to get some help. And I went to get some help. I went to the care unit in August of 1985, and I stayed sober for 90 days. But I had some reservations. These things that we talk about in this book have come to light for me in my experience. It talks about if you're going to be sober, there could be no lurking notion, no reservations, right? And I didn't know. Sometimes you don't know you have one till you cash it in. But I didn't know, because I'm such a cold smoker, I didn't know that I really hadn't conceded to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And that concession is a big deal. Admitting in the first step is talk about we admit it, we were powerless. But the first step is not, step one is not the first step in recovery. Step one is not the first step in recovery. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. There's a step A that's under step one. And because I admitted that I'm powerless, because, shit, I like talking, and that's the price of admission to talk. You know, everybody said, you know, you got to say you're alcoholic. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, you know. And I kind of thought I was, you know. But in the back of my mind, you know, I had a couple of lurking notions. One reservation, now that I'm sober and now that I'm not getting loaded no more, I know I can sell dope. Reservation. Didn't check, I didn't cast that one in. But the other reservation that was lurking and I didn't know it was I hadn't fully conceded. It's not what you say up there. It's not what you say sitting up looking at down. I hadn't fully conceded. And sponsors that's sitting out here, people, how many sponsors we got? I can't give nobody the concession. I can't give anybody surrender. I can't give anybody desire. Couldn't give it to me. I cannot will it on my, you know, for me, I didn't surrender. I was surrendered. because I'm not a surrendering guy. If Charlie is beating me down, I might say, Charlie, I give up because I want to get him off me. And when he turns his back, I might pick a brick up if it's close. If it ain't nothing close and he a big guy, I'm going to let him walk, but I'm laying wait. Now, if he keep on, then pretty soon he'll surrender me. I can't whoop Charlie, you know. I better go get my daddy, you know. And that's what we do in step two, but we ain't going to go to two yet, you know. We ain't going to go there yet, you know, because I can't whoop Charlie. I hadn't conceded. I might say it with my mouth. But when that last time I'm laying down there and it come to me, I don't want to fool with Charlie, you know. And that's what happened with me. You know, when I was sitting up, I was out. On day 89, one of my brothers, my older brother, his ex-girl, good friend of mine, I had introduced him. She and me were tight. And she knew I had had a problem with this, she knew I had a little problem with this cocaine thing. But nobody knows except us the depths of what it is we're doing. She didn't know I don't need to be touching anything. I'm not telling her. And we out of the club. Ralph, you looking good. You doing so well. You know, and she go dance with a guy. And she left her Long Island iced tea on the table. Me and the Long Island. I'm looking at it, it's looking at me, you know. And I sipped the Long Island. And I drank the Long Island. And I put my hand on the top of the Long Island. I had about $65 in my pocket. I said, Deb, take me home. And I was around the corner, and I was at a spot. And I didn't make it back from that August of 1985 until November of 1985, until October of 1986. Sweetly reasonable from my own experience. You can't talk to a guy like me. You know, Tamisha's in a workshop I do, and we were talking the other day. You know, and you don't appeal to the alcoholic. You don't appeal to me through my mind. You don't get to my head through my mind. You know, you get to this head through my ass. I know we in a monastery. Excuse me. That's how you get me. Bam. You spank that hard enough, that mind opens up. Ooh. But you slap me upside the head, I just close. But you. Bam. And I had a well-whooped one when I came back. I was sweetly reasonable, you know, from my own experience. And this deal that I suffer from, you know, and that idea, that struggle with powerlessness, you know, for a guy like me, it got beat out of me. And I never, ever, ever, ever had entertained the idea of entire abstinence till I got to you guys. So my story and everybody's story. So the reason we tell stories, and we're a storytelling society, and the reason we tell stories, and the reason that we're an identifying society, is because there are many different stories and portraits of the alcoholic in the as there are alcoholics. There are as many different portraits. And so everybody's story, it may not be the same. I've heard many people in that first step experience would come to grips with this idea of powerlessness over this thing, that alcohol was my master, the quicksand stressed out. I've heard many people share, I tried over and over and over to stop. I tried and I couldn't. And that ain't my experience. My experience here in looking back was all of the times that I thought I was exerting control over it, it had control over me. Because I'm the guy every 2 weeks. I never intended to spend a whole paycheck. You know, I'm just going to spend 20. Check the matter of fact, scratch that last sentence. For many years, I never intended to spend a whole paycheck. But when you descend like I descend, cold thing about the disease I suffer from, sometimes they say insanity is doing the same thing, expecting different results. Here's insane insanity, doing the same thing, knowing the results. See, because I got to that place where I knew, didn't care. That's it. I didn't know that's how my powerlessness looked. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice because it didn't seem to me that I was ever trying to exert a choice. I didn't know that I had a gorilla that was shot calling for me. I did know that when I said I need to pay rent, something else said, oh, no. I did know when I said that baby need diapers, the gorilla said, oh, really? I did know when I said I got to be at work at 9 o'clock and I was in the motel with you and I still had something, the gorilla said, work? Really? I'm that guy. I'm that guy. And so when I got to you guys, there were some things for me in that first step, you know, that really, you know, that were meaningful, impactful, and still are. There are some things that I had to learn about me. Some things I learned, some things were concessions, and some things were realizations. you know, and realizations are different than learning them, it's realizing them. One of the things that was a realization, that there's something physically different about me. I suspected it, I had it wrong. I thought that the reason I got so loaded was because I got high capacity. Mm-hmm. You know, you run with the big dogs, if you roll over here, you know, poop us, no, don't roll with us. You know, the guys that I want to roll with, and one of the things that I like the most, I'm going to bounce around and then I'm going to sit down and get us to charge. You know, one of the reasons why it was very important for me, this is where some of the knowledge and the information comes clear for me, is it was really important for me to understand the difference in classifications of alcohol. And I didn't know, why is that in there anyway? The heavy drinker, the social drinker, the moderate drinker, and the real life. Because I ran with a crew of six dudes. Two of my boys put me down in the game. They were deeper in it than I was in it. Got married, graduated from school, started making money. We cool. Out of the six, one is with you guys. And only one of them started out squarer than me. These other guys were matching me step for step for step for step for step. But they don't have that thing. They don't have that thing. And the thing about that thing, you don't get to go to the doctor. I went to the doctor for a complete physical 2 years ago. They told me they did some tests, and they have a test in this diabetes deal, and there's something where you're a range from 156 to 165, and that's pre-diabetes. If you hit 165 over, you diabetic. And they told me, dude, you need to change some stuff about you. You're about a 158, you know. And they could look at something. They could look at a test, and they could say, you are pre-diabetic. If they'd have grabbed you and took you to the doctor 20 years ago, if they'd have snatched you up and took you 20 years ago, if they'd have took you for a test 35 years ago, Charlie, if they'd have put me in something, then they could not have said, Ralph White, you pre-alcoholic.
Pre-alcoholic.
Cold thing about the disease that I suffer from. No way to know that I'm on that trail. And I had to diagnose it for myself. You know, and so this descent into that kind of powerlessness for me. You know, I learned some stuff along the way. This is something physically different, and I was able to match it up against my experience. I was able to match it against all the times that I said I would manage. I never said I would stop, so I didn't have that experience. But I had it against all the times I said I would manage, all the times I said I was just going to spend 20, all the times I said I'm going to be home at a certain time, all the time I said I'm going to pay the rent on time, all the time that I said I'm going to make it to this appointment on time, all the time that I said, you know you got a final in the morning. What the hell are you doing out till 3:30? All you know you get married tomorrow. What the hell are you doing at your bachelor party till 7 o'clock? You know, all the times I did those things that I did. All the things, it explained some things that have been unexplainable to me up until that point. You know, and so that idea of powerlessness, and once I embraced it, you know, that darkness, you know, and that's the thing about it. And I'm not going to go too far, but on October the 11th, it was like a tsunami had been coming on me, wave after wave after wave after wave after wave, washing away my life, just erode my life. And on October the 11th, 1986, bam, something happened. The wave stopped in midair. The wave stopped in midair. I did what Bill Wilson did, and I did what most of How Dark It Is. I had a How Dark It Is Before the Dawn day. I'm not going to go into what happened after that. I'm going to stay stuck right here on step one, because we're going to talk about step two. But I'm going to talk about what happened with that wave stuck in midair.
Thank you, Ralph. Am I on? All right. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm alcoholic.
Charlie.
Hi, everybody. So happy to be here. I'm really looking forward to this weekend. I've been here. It's the third time I've been here, so this building is kind of special to me. We were here in 2010, right before my sponsor at the time was Mark Houston. And my sponsor now is a guy named Myers R. From Texas. But it's really nice to be in this building. You know, my home group's the primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Austin, Texas. If you're ever in Austin on a Tuesday night, come see us. We're at 2701 South Lamar. It's a line-by-line big book study meeting, and it's just a lot more fun than it sounds like. I know you guys had come, but you know, the amazing thing is, because there was a time that meeting wouldn't have appealed to me that much, you know. But now we have 225 people generally on a Tuesday night studying the big book, and I like to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is making a big comeback in AA, you know, because but you guys definitely got a pocket of enthusiasm here, you know, and you can feel it, you know. And that's one of the cool things about traveling around is you see little pockets of enthusiasm. And of course, you know, our common friend Bob, whenever I say pockets of enthusiasm, he always says, that's Charlie's code for people that are doing it right, you know. And I've definitely, you know, had my times of going around trying to stamp out improper sobriety, you know, and that sort of thing. But we were here in 2010, me and Katie, and then we were here in 2015. And some of you know my blushing bride, Katie, and she sends her regards. She's at home this weekend, and everything's going well. But I got to tell a couple of quick stories before we get going. Brandon picked me up at the airport, and we stopped at a we were going to go to Wendy's to get a salad on the way here, and then we see the sign that says barbecue soul food, and we're like, I want to go there, and so we just about knocked ourselves unconscious on the way over here. But I was having oxtail and collard greens, and I think I could find my way back there. But what I was going to tell you is I got this text, you know, this little group text, and they said, Brandon's going to pick you up, and Ralph will be there with you. And I sent back a thing. I said, hot dog, you know. And I didn't know what I was kicking off, but me and Brandon got off on this whole hot dog theme pun fest, you know, where it was like, and he was sending little memes of himself in a hot dog bun, you know. And I was like, that's cool. I don't know how you did that, but that was cool, you know. I mean, I quit with like Asteroids was the last game I played, so I'm not too high tech, you know. Then we got into this little pun fest where, you know, he says, I'll pick you up at the airport. And I said, that sounds like a wiener. And I was like, you know, I've really been looking forward to catch up with you, you know. And, you know, and just, it's like that for a minute. And so he says, I'm in baggage claim on the left. And I walk up, and I'll have to show you the picture. 6-foot hot dog standing at the top of the escalator when I get up there. He says, you can't miss me. I'm at the top of the escalator. And when I come up there, he had a hot dog costume on with a bun. It was all the way over his head. He had a bun and mustard and everything. I'm like, you are my kind of, I'd have drank with you in a minute, you know. But it's funny because that's my highest compliment when I meet somebody in AA now, is that when I go, oh, I'd have drank with him, you know. I mean, I'd like to say I don't have any judgment, but there's some guys in AA I wouldn't have drank with them if they had a keg in their living room, you know. I mean, but we're going to talk a little bit about this pull of one alcoholic to another one. But I'm so excited to be here with Ralph. I've done some stuff with his brother Ron. I so feel for Mrs. White when he says that there were 6 boys and all of them were in the life. It just, I had 2, you know, and that about did me in. My 2 daughters are both sober, and you know, that's just a lot coming at you. But this whole monastic environment here, Mark Houston was my sponsor and changed my whole life. And I met Mark when I had about 16 or 17 years of sobriety. Now, I promise you, I'm going to talk about Mark. Now, there's going to be times this weekend where I'll be talking, and I'll say, we're going to get back to that later. And because I got a little ADD working, I get scattered. I go off on a little bunny trail sometimes. When I say we'll get back to that later, that means that this ain't the right time. Like when he dipped into step 2, it's like I go, no, this isn't the right time to introduce that piece of information right now. So we're going to get back to that later. But when I tell you we're coming back to it, we're probably not coming back. You know? it's like I always get real excited if I actually circle back around to one, you know. But Mark was really drawn to that. In fact, selfishly, I had a fear Mark was really drawn to monastic discipline. He went to the Nut House at 9 years sober behind untreated alcoholism and PTSD from Vietnam. And he became so disciplined about, the first time I met Mark, he was talking about the disciplines of 10, 11, 12, the disciplines of 10, 11, living the strict spiritual disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. And when I'm in the disciplines of, and I'm out there in the audience going, la, 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 you know, just because I ain't even in the same area code as the strict disciplines of 10, 11, and 12 when I met him. I didn't know what he was talking about. I was really hoping that he wouldn't call on me. But he was so drawn to that monastic discipline. I mean, he'd get up at 4 and do his stuff and had a, you know, a little place in his apartment that was all set up for all that. And, you know, 1 minute is Buddhism, 1 minute is Christianity. But if you haven't ever checked out Mark, get a hold of some of it. But, you know, I was always afraid he was going to go off and join a monastery. You know, I really was. You know, and then what am I going to do? You know, I think about me a little bit, you know, and we're going to talk about that some, I promise you. You know, but I do got to tell you one quick joke before we get going. I like to get the crowd warmed up with a little joke, and it's about this guy. His life ain't going real well, so he thinks, I'm going to go join this contemplative monastery like this one. You know, and the story, the thing is though, at this one, you don't get to say anything. You know, and he signs up, and he's here. But now at this one, you get to every 5 years, you get to say. You get to write down 2 words. You don't ever get to say anything, but every 5 years you get to write down 2 years. So he's out there working and he's cutting the garden and he's keeping everything. 5 years go by and he walks into the head guy's office and he gets to write down one little piece of paper and he slides it off there and it says, bed hard. And the guy says, and he goes back to work. Another 5 years go by. He's out there working away, you know, and after 5 years, he gets to write down 2 more words. And he comes in there, and he writes down. And the guy looks at it and says, food bad. And he goes back to work for another 5 years. And he's out there sweeping and cutting and everything. And after 5 years come in, he slides a little piece of paper across the desk, and it says, I quit. The guy looks at it and goes, well, you might as well. You've done nothing but bitch ever since you got here. You know? So, there's a little perspective, you know, there. But you know, I just they're going to vote. I want to share a little experience around the silent dining because when Katie and I now, how many of y'all have heard? How many of y'all heard Katie talk? I love Katie, but she's a lot coming at you, and I need adult supervision, so it's good to have her in my life. But man, she's on me like white on rice, and so we came here, and they said, well, we're going to vote on whether it's going to be silent dining or you can talk in the dining room. They said, since you guys have the whole property, you can vote. And so I'm like, oh, I want the silence. I want the whole monastic experience, you know, and say, okay, so we vote to have silent dining. And there's a little room down the hall, though, where you can talk. And that room is jammed. I mean, you know, and I try to come down there, and Katie's like, oh, no, Mr. Monastic Environment. You know, you go back to the silent dining room. But the funniest thing that happened was we get in there, and y'all experienced that dinner tonight, and it was great tonight. I don't remember the salad bar. I remember that soup. But I remember going in there, I got a little piece of bread, and I go over to get a pat of butter. Now, Katie's always watching me. And I go pick up this pat of butter, and it's as hard as this table. I mean, it's like it just come out of the freezer. So now she knows at the time, I ain't going to church. I do my 10 and 11, that's what, but some things have changed since then. But I'm sitting there, and she knows that I ain't really that guy, you know. And I come in, but I'm trying to, she's getting her tray, and I come in, and I got a pat of butter like this. And it's frozen, and I put it in my hands, and I go like that. And then I'm warming it up, and she comes around the corner, and she looks at me, and she goes, oh, you are a big phony. And I go, you know, and show her the butter. And you know that thing, you know that minute when you're with your sister or something, and something funny happens, and you can't laugh, and you just got to laugh? You know, I mean, we busted up in the middle of the silent dining room, but that was my first experience here was the butter prayer. You know, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. There's some things going on. I got an email list up here. I'll send you some stuff when we got home. I got a Some of you may have a big book old enough that still has a circle and triangle in the front of it. If it doesn't, they took it out in 94. We're putting it back in one big book at a time. So during the break, if you'll bring your big book up here, I'll stamp it for you, and we can talk later about this circle and triangle exercise. So that's about all I got going on. You know, got all that out of the way. I'm so looking forward to this weekend. And it's funny, I do a lot of them with Katie, but I've been really looking forward to doing one with Ralph. Because, I mean, I know if nothing else, I mean, and, you know, I don't know. And when he was sitting there talking that first time, you weren't 5 minutes in where I thought, I can't follow that. You know, when he said the one about I can't whoop Charlie, so I got to go to my father, and I'm like, oh, that's good. I'm using that. Has that ever been recorded before? You know, and Danny Brown and I are always trading stories, and I go, he'll say something really clever, and I'll go, have you ever said that from a podium? And he's like, no, I don't think so. I go, you better hurry, you know, because I'm going to be saying it. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and for that I am truly grateful. That's amazing. We got a couple of busted up drunks like us. We got 67 years of sobriety between the two of us. This program works. I'm seeing people here that were at other ones, like the first one we did. It's a wonderful thing because I'm a big fan of the people that stay around. There's a lot of message for the newcomer, but I'm sick of losing middle management. I'm sick of losing the 5-year, 15-year, 25-year people that are. So I really am about having a continuing experience. And if you're not feeling it, that there might be more available than what we're experiencing, because that's my story. That, you know, I mean, Ralph talked a good bit about what it was like. I started drinking when I was. Well, I had my first drink when I was 13. I didn't really get at it good till I was 16. And it sounds like we're not exactly all about singleness of purpose here. But I got a lot of experience with outside issues. Deep experience with outside issues. I didn't miss much. To my knowledge, there wasn't anything, and I certainly never turned down anything. In fact, it always cracks me up. Some of that treatment center language that you hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, where they go, have y'all heard the term drug of choice? You know, that just tickles the heck out of me. I mean, because I think it's so silly. I mean, you know, like I'm ever going to be over at your house, and you pull something out, and I go, what's that? Oh no, that's not my particular drug of choice, you know. It's like, you boys go ahead. I'll just sit over here and wait for my DOC to appear. You know, it's like, whatever you got to be fine. And I went through different periods. And you know, it's funny. We both got books made by my sponsor. Now these are both just AA big books that most of you have seen these. Myers does these, but there are very few things in this book that don't apply to me. And Ralph said it too, is one of the lines that doesn't really apply to me is the line that says our stories are filled with countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like normal men. I don't have any experience with that. And that's not everybody's. I'd like to tell you that from the time I was 16 till I sobered up at 28, that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day or something really macho like that. That wouldn't be true. But I can tell you the truth of my story, and this isn't everybody in AA, is from the time I tried it till the time I rolled in here, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time for any reason under any circumstances. There was never a time where I said, oh, I know, you know, it's my mother's birthday tomorrow or anything like that. It was just always go, and I didn't have any attempt at, I've always been self-employed. How many people in the room are self-employed? It's usually a bunch of us, you know. Because we just don't work well for other people, but you know it's funny. I used to have this fence company that my buddies called. We started calling it Afternoon Fence Company, because when they'd call and say, "When are you going to be here?" I'd be, "Oh, we'll be out there this afternoon," you know. And then one of my buddies started calling it Tomorrow Afternoon Fence Company. You know, probably ain't coming today. You know, but you know. I drank an awful lot, and I did a lot of other stuff, and so I went through periods where. But like another guy says, I always drank, but I never just drank. I was always drinking and doing this, drinking and doing that, drinking and doing that. And there are people that say the only reason I drank was the only reason I did this kind of dope was so I could drink more. That is not my experience. To me, I have no way of separate. I talk about, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I talk about alcoholism because I'm a big believer in singleness of purpose. We may get a chance to talk about that identification piece of alcoholism that the whole singleness of purpose is built on, and we may not. But I don't have any way of separating my drinking and my drug use. It was, to me, it was all part of getting loaded. I was about everything and about anything, and I did it as long as I could. My sobriety has been March 22nd, two different times. March 22nd of 84, March 22nd of 85. And I wasn't trying to do anything cute there, I promise you. Like Ralph said, that's not the way this deal works. You know, I had a woman one time go, oh, did you do that on purpose? You're like, oh, yeah, I had that kind of manageability. You bet. Yeah, I'm going to quit on Friday. That'll be really cool. You know, I was like, I looked up, I had a few days, and this guy gave his sobriety date in the meeting. I thought, I wonder what mine is. And I counted back 4 days. I went, I'll be damned. It's March 22nd again. I don't know what that means, But the shortest version of my using is that the guys that I drank with thought I did too much dope. And the guys that I did dope with were shocked by my drinking. So everybody thought Charlie was getting a little too loaded. There wasn't. And so by the time I came in, there wasn't anybody like saying, oh, wow, I never knew you had a problem or anything. You know, it was not the first time that the topic had been brought up. But I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. And I had this maintenance man at my apartment that came in. Every morning he'd come in. He was sober, but he was on what we call the marijuana maintenance program now. And he would come in, we're getting ready to go to college, and we're doing bong hits to get ready for school. And he would come in and sit with us. He kept talking about treatment, 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 treatment. I don't know why he thought we gave a flip about hearing about it, but he kept talking about treatment. And one of the really bad pieces of advice he gave me was he said, before you go to treatment, you might want to go pull a really good drunk because they're going to make you not want to drink anymore. And I remember thinking, I'm on it, and that really good drunk took 9 months, and for 9 months, I was fixing to go to treatment. We're in the South, we can say fixing, right? Yeah, okay, I was up in Canada, and the whole ask it basket was about colloquialisms, and what do you mean fix it? You're like, it's preparing to, it's not repairing, it's preparing to. Katie said, I got to have a sponsor that tells me how the cow ate the cabbage and just blew their minds. I mean, they were there. I don't even know what that means, but that was in the ask it basket too. Yeah. You got to tell me how the cow ate the cabbage. That's something that can tell you how what really happened, what's really going down. Yeah. That's one that's, I think that's probably a little before my time. And, so when you were, some of those old references, Katie cracked me up. She was somewhere the other day, and she talked about this some kind of a disease. She said her disease is like a game of Pong. And then she goes, for you millennials out there, if you don't know what Pong is, she goes, for God's sake, look it up. I have to look up your terms all the time. So you can look up what Pong was. But, there's a lot of my phrases that may not be, because when you were talking about candid camera, that's what it was. And I was going to go, it's kind of like punked. But hell, punked is 20 years old now, so I don't even know. But I came into treatment that time, and towards the end, I was drinking. A typical day was we'd go get a half gallon of ice. I had two other guys that I ran with. I didn't have a place of my own the last year and a half I was drinking. And I loved it when Ralph said he wound up back in Mother's house. I was so poorly treated as a child that I ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I'm serious, never went back, But I mean, I had other places during the time, but like any good gangster, we always wound up back at Mom's house, And it was getting sloppy and things weren't going that well. And things that used to work weren't working so good. But when we talk about that losing that choice of control, when I talk about step one, I like to talk about the loss of choice and control. And on page 24, it talks about at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. So most of us know what the only requirement for membership is in AA. What is it? A desire to stop drinking will get me a front row seat in any AA meeting in the world. But it says right there on page 24 that it won't do a darn thing to keep me sober. It says the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of no avail. Anybody that can, you know, so that's what we talk about a lot in step one. You know, out of all our steps, you know, it spends the doctor's opinion in the first 44 pages talking about the problem. You know, what made AA a big deal was an understanding of the problem and then a solution to our problem. But then even if, you know, the book is full of references where it was three things that made us a big deal, but the book is full of stories where people had two of them. You know, where they, like somebody understood the problem and the solution, but they didn't have a program of action. That was Carl Jung. That was Carl Jung when he said, you know, when Roland Hazard comes to him and he says, you got the mind of a hopeless alcoholic. You know, I mean, that's a... When you go to the doctor, you don't want your doctor using words like doomed. You know, that's a bad doctor's visit, you know. And he tells him, he goes, and he says what any good drunk would say. He goes, come on, doc, it's old Charlie here, man. I mean, don't you have anything? And he goes, well, here and there, once in a while, we've seen people have these vital spiritual experiences. But you know, but and the thing about and that, what really brought that home to me was one time, I've been organizing this AA golf tournament in Austin called the Legends of Sobriety. It's a long story, but at a golf course, they have a guy called the Marshal that goes around in a cart and he makes sure you don't drive up on the greens or play too slow and all this stuff. So we're waiting to play, and this Marshal comes up in the cart, and we're about five deep waiting to play the next hole. And so he pulls up there, and he goes, so you guys are AA? And I said, yeah, yeah. And he goes, my father was an alcoholic, and I went over and I sat down in his cart with him. He goes, my dad was the worst man you'd ever hope to meet. He said he was a racist. He was a bigot. He was an abusive dad. He was an abusive husband. And he drank hopelessly. And he's just the worst guy you'd ever want to meet. And he goes, well, one day in his late 60s, he got sick. And he was in the hospital. And he went into a coma. And he said, we all went to see him. And we're standing around the bed. And he's out, and then all of a sudden he stirs and he raises both hands up in the arms in the air like this. I don't know if this is the right time to be telling this story, but I'm way deep in it right now. So he's laying in the bed and he raises both hands. His eyes are still closed and he raises both hands up like this, and he says he starts talking to people that we can't see, and he's talking about world peace, and he's talking about ending world hunger, and he's talking about stuff like that. And then he says, I have to leave you now, but a better man is coming to take my place. And he said, both his arms went boom, dropped down on the bed. He said, we thought he was dead. He goes, we weren't dead. He said, he comes out of the coma, and for the rest of his life, he's a completely different dude. No racism, no bigotry, happy all the time, nice to people. You know, he says he kept a fifth of whiskey under the sink in the kitchen in case somebody came over, never touched a drop of it for the rest of his life. Complete emotional transformation. Now imagine how Carl Jung felt when he's saying, I know what the disease is, the answer is one of these, but we need to get you one of those, you know? He's like, I got no flipping idea how to make it happen. But he says, you know, here and there, once in a while, we've seen people have these vital spiritual experiences. But he's like, I don't know how to make it happen. You know, and the big deal with AA is that we have an understanding of the problem of alcoholism. We know what the solution is. It talks about it about five different ways. But we also have a program of action that'll bring it about. That's what makes us a big deal. Because then there's other stories where, like with Dr. Bob, he knew what the solution was. It says he sensed that a spiritual remedy might solve his problem. And he even had a program of action. He'd been in the Oxford movement for a couple of years where they had that six-step program and that sort of thing. But he didn't understand the problem. It wasn't until Bill came to him and explained the disease to it the way Silkworth explained it to him, and it says he sobered up never to drink again for the rest of his life. And so this proved that one alcoholic working with another could have an effect where nobody else could. You know, that's the thing about this identification that we talk about. The reason we talk about singleness of purpose is not that we don't want the filthy dope fiend in our AA meetings. It's whatever, you know, it's this identification. On page 18, it talks about that identification. And it says, because it says, well, let's just see what it says. It says, highly competent psychiatrists who've dealt with this find it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation. We're the only group of people I know of that'll go pay a psychiatrist $225 an hour and lie to him the whole time, right? I mean, think about it. If I go in there and he goes, tell me, Mr. Parker, do you drink? I'm not going to go, oh, yeah, buddy. I like me some drinking. I like to get a half gallon of vodka and a case of beer in the morning and just see what the day brings. You know, I mean, I'm not going to say that. You know, but it says wives, parents, and intimate friends find us even more unapproachable than do the doctor or the psychiatrist. And then he goes into that squiggly writing where it says, but the ex-problem drinker who's found this solution, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win. And to me, a lot of being properly armed with the facts about myself is being able to break down for this new guy what it means to be an alcoholic. You know, I call it giving a guy a first step experience. I work with guys, so I say guys. But my first job when I sit down with a guy is to give him what I call a first step experience or a fatal dose of alcoholism. There's no good news at the end of step one. But it says, the really important part of that whole piece is when it speaks to singleness of purpose, it says, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. What did they say? They said, until that understanding is reached, that understanding of one alcoholic, like I said, by the time I got here, it wasn't the first time the topic of how drunk Charlie gets had been brought up. You know, it had been a frequent topic at family gatherings. You know, I didn't know why I got so loaded. You know, why do you have to get so loaded? You know, and we talk like everybody knows the answer to all these questions, but they don't. I mean, think about, remember when you would promise people that you're never going to drink again, and you mean it with everything you got. And then they'd see me drunk or they'd see you drinking, and they always ask that question. They say, why'd you start drinking again? And we give them the only answer we got, which is what? It's like a chorus in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I said that at Founders Day one time. There were 6,500 people in the room, and it was just throughout the crowd. I don't know. God Almighty, I don't know. It's what I do. You know, I disappoint people. I hurt people that love me. I make promises I don't keep. And by the time I get here, I'm thinking, disease my butt. There's something bad wrong with me. Because I promise people, you know, that singleness of purpose. Like I said, people have been talking to me about the way I drink. But most of us remember the first time you talk to somebody where you go, I can tell Ralph, I'd have drank with Ralph. I'd have drank with Brandon. It would have been disastrous, but I'd have drank with Brandon. You know, and I can, you know, but there's something that happens when you feel that energy. If he hadn't been in a hot dog suit today, one of my favorite games to play when Katie and I get to go to these conferences is when they say, you know, Billy Joe Jimbob's going to come pick you up at the airport, Billy Joe Jimbob will call me and say, hey, listen, I'm about 5'10". I go, don't even tell me, just be in baggage claim, have your cell phone on you. And I can't even tell you how many times I've come down the escalator and looked around and gone, there's our boy right there, you know. And you walk over and you go, are you Billy Joe Jimbob? He's like, yeah, how'd you know? And you're like, oh, I can feel you, brother. You know, I mean, because we can feel each other on an energy level. That's why geographic cures don't work for us, because you can plop me down in Atlanta, and in about 10 seconds I go, he looks like he parties, you know, and off we go, you know, because we're drawn to each other on an energy level. But on that, it says until such... That identification is so important that out of all the 12-step programs that there are out there, the only difference in any of them, and there's a bunch of 12-step programs. There's Alcoholics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous. I even heard there's a Lip Balm Addicts Anonymous, in case anybody's ever suffered from that heartbreaking malady. You know, but I could tell you a story, I just don't have the time. I'm going to tell it anyway. I went on their website one time because I said, look at this treatment. And every time I say that, there's always somebody out there with their CarMax going, oh, I feel you, buddy. I know exactly what you're talking about. I look at this treatment center one time, and it said links to outside resources, and one of them said Lip Balm Addicts Anonymous. And I said, let's go there. And we went, and they had a blog site, and somebody had blogged in and said, I'm thinking about this L'Oreal lip process, and I was thinking about trying it, but I don't know, what do you think? And the person answered and said, well, you have to be very careful with any kind of lip process, because you could start off with a harmless lip process, and before you know it, you're back to your lip balm of choice, and before you know it, you're right back at rock bottom. And I'm sitting there going, oh, come on, you know. But I mean, you think about it, when we talk about this singleness of purpose, if that identification ain't there, you know, imagine if, you know, somebody comes into the meeting and says, hey, listen, there's no LBA meetings around today. You know, would y'all mind if we talked about lip balm today? You know, you're like, no, we won't, because there's not that identification that takes place. But when that identification is there, and I can tell that you drank like I did and you're not drinking anymore, I'm going to ask you what to do, and I might be willing to take actions that I don't even believe in yet. I used to think it was really important that you tell me what we're going to do, what's it going to feel like, how's it going to go, what's the end result going to be, and I thought it was really important that I approve of the whole process, right? But when I'm in that surrendered place of that step one experience, all you're going to hear out of me is, what do you want me to do? And the next thing you're going to hear is, okay, I did that, now what do we do? And that's when we roll. But step one drives me into all of this stuff. And, you know, the shortest version of step one is, and I like to talk about it because I spent a good deal of time in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous saying, my name's Charlie and I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't know what it meant. I knew if there was such a thing as an alcoholic, I probably was one. I didn't know anybody that drank more than I did. I've met some since then. There's some people in these rooms with some impressive stories. I mean, this is the only group of people where you can say, yeah, I got a DWI and blew 4.1 blood alcohol level. We're like, 4.1, that's pretty solid. You know, that's no candy ass drunk there, you know, but I don't even know why I said that. But I would raise my hands. I didn't know what it meant, and it took somebody. So being able, you know, we talk about not being able to get somebody to surrender. That is the one thing that is really crazy to observe, is when is somebody going to surrender? What somebody's going to bottom going to be? I can't call it. Some guys will. I had a trainer at the gym that told me this. Is apparently an old story. I thought I'd go ahead and serve that one to myself, you know. I said, better to serve it to yourself than have it served to you, you know. But he said he was an alcoholic one time. I said, well, tell me about your drinking. He said, I left a bachelor's party one night, and I rolled my car, you know. And I'm thinking, anybody in this room would just go, oh, I knew I shouldn't have taken I-35 on the way home. You know, I was like, you don't quit drinking, you know. I mean, I spent a good deal of time not really knowing what, but when it says properly armed with the facts about himself, I really think being able to break down for that, you know, when you can start off, and we're going to talk about it next, when it talks about we agnostics, and it says we hope in the preceding pages you've learned something of alcoholism, but now they're thinking we know what it means to be an alcoholic, and what it means in the shortest version is that I got two problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it, and the other one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I don't struggle with alcohol. It only gives me trouble when I'm drinking it and when I'm not drinking it. When I'm drinking it, it triggered. It talks about it on Roman numeral 28. That's a heavy, heavy page. You need to spend a lot of time in when you're working with people. But it says we believe that the accident of alcohol in these chronic is a manifestation of an allergy. That's the piece that happens when I drink it. And it talks about that craving that Ralph was talking about, that when I start drinking, something happens to me. It doesn't happen to my sister. But there's something that happens to me that ain't regular when I drink. If I drink 4 ounces of vodka, I can't tell you how much I'm going to drink or when I'm going to stop. And the most important thing you can do with anything this book says or anything I say is lay it up against your experience and see if it's the truth. What happens when you start drinking? But the problem for me was I never thought I triggered the phenomenon of craving. You know, I mean, I just thought I changed my mind. You know, I thought, you know, yeah, I thought, I know I said I was going to have a couple, but I don't want to have a couple. You know, and we were... We were out at Bob's place in Las Vegas one time, and we went to this halfway house, and there was a guy in that meeting that I just fell in love with. This guy was in this sober house, and he's talking. He ain't trying to be funny. He's just sitting there. He's in sober living, and he goes, "Man, it sucks that I'm alcoholic." You know, and there's a little silence. He goes, "I wish I wasn't alcoholic so I could drink all the time." I mean, can you feel that guy? Because he's sitting there going, you know, out of everything, the one thing I really love doing, that's what I got to be allergic to? You know, why can't I be gluten intolerant or something? You know, I mean, it's, you know, and he goes, "I wish I could just drink like 7 drinks." And I'm like, that is my man right there. You know, I ain't trying, I don't want 2, but 7 seems reasonable, you know. But, I mean, but we got to be able to break this down, because when I got here, I promise you, I drank at this little place in East Dallas called the Spillway Pub. And I promise you, I never one time walked in there, Bobby was the owner, I never once walked in there and leaned up against the bar and went, "Oh, Bobby, 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 Bobby. God almighty, the spiritual malady is on me today." You know, I had a beer on the way over here, and it has triggered a phenomenon of craving. You know, I mean, nobody talks like that. This is all stuff I've learned since we got here. But we can bring the bottom up for a guy if we can make a thing. We're taking a guy from "I like to party" and they have bad luck and things are, you know, bad things happen, to you have a physical allergy that whenever you start drinking, it's always going to get away from you. It's really bad news, but it's not the worst news. You know, if the worst news was what happens when you drink 4 ounces of vodka, your answer would be real simple. It'd be just don't drink vodka. But the second piece of it is that I don't get okay when I stop drinking. You know, when I stop drinking, my problems don't go away. It feels like somebody cranks the heat up on them a little bit, you know, and I start getting restless. I start getting irritable. And things, now I never thought I was irritable, but in fact, there's a little arrogance in just knowing that I'm keenly aware of how stupid everybody else is. Right? Does that happen to anybody after a little minute? You know, and all of a sudden my boss is bugging me. And one thing I notice is in traffic, even in sobriety, anybody going slower than me is a moron, and anybody going faster than me is a maniac. So keep your eyes on me, because I'm always going the right speed. You know, and it's that way. I got this. This thing that happens, I've got a little chart here that talks about where it says, first, I get separated from God. And after I get separated from God, I have a lack of power to be able to live effectively because of what we're going to talk about in step 3. And then I become restless, irritable, discontented. And after a while, if that goes on enough, I'm on a quest for relief and comfort. And when I get to that point, I only got 2 ways to go. One is to drink. And the other is a conscious relationship with this power we're going to talk about in step 2. But I don't know those are my choices. I don't know that's the turning point. You know, when it says we stood at the turning point, there's no flashing red sign at the turning point. But it talks about it on page 25. It talks about it on a couple other pages where it says whether to go on to the bitter end or blot out the consciousness of our intolerance. Now, the sad thing is there's plenty of people sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous today trying to blot out the consciousness of their intolerable situation. Or to accept spiritual help. You know, we're about out of time, aren't we? Okay. I got some really good stories, but... Okay. Well, there is something that happens when you're really able to break down this physical allergy coupled with the mental obsession, and I've seen it brings about a surrender. I've seen it happen dozens of times, even out of treatment center and stuff, where you see guys lean forward. They're having what I call a step 1 experience, where they lean forward in their chair and they're going, "Hold on just a minute. I've been in and out of AA for 18 years, and I've never heard the stuff you're talking about. It explains a lot of stuff I've never been able to. It explains why when I start drinking, it always gets away from me. It explains why when I swear to God I'm not going to drink again, I drink again, and I drink again, and I drink again." Somebody that can make up their mind to pull themselves up by the bootstraps doesn't even belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people like me that swear to God and mean it with every fiber of my being that I ain't never going to do this again, and I do it again. Because when I'm making those promises, I don't know that I don't have the power to make good on them. That's the powerless I'm talking about in step one. I don't have the power to manage that decision to not drink. And that is borne out by my experience. So there's something that happens when I realize that I got no shot. I got no shot, like stepping in the ring with Mike Tyson. I couldn't beat him with a pocket knife. There is a surrender that takes place in the face of that powerlessness. And tied to that surrender is a willingness that drives me into the next step. And that's what we're going to talk about next, is where this takes me and where we find the power to manage that decision. So thanks a lot, everybody. I'm real happy to be here.